Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, as thousands of Central Ohio kids head back to school, Jay Fox will speak with a doctor about the importance of eye exams. Jay will also speak with experts about distracted driving and rising insurance costs. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective...
Columbus City Schools is the largest school district in Ohio, serving over 45,000 students across 113 schools. But they're not the only school district in Central Ohio, which has an estimated student population of over 500,000 students. Nearly 75% of kids' vision issues are missed at traditional school eye screenings. As a result, parents might want to consider adding an in-person comprehensive eye exam as they prepare to go back to school this year. Dr. Jackie Bowen is the president of the American Optometric Association Board of Trustees, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
How bad are these eye exams at the school that we need to schedule a prospective comprehensive eye exam as part of our back-to-school necessities?
Well, the screenings are not bad, whether they're at school or the pediatrician's office or in the community. But we know that they only identify about 4% of the vision issues, whereas 100% of those issues, eye health and vision, are identified in a comprehensive exam with an optometrist. Additionally, even if a child fails a screening and gets a referral for a comprehensive exam, 60% of the time, that doesn't happen. So it makes sense to me that if you have one pair of eyes and your child has to use them their whole entire life, attention by a doctor of optometry on a regular basis is extremely important. The eyes are pretty sneaky. They don't tell you about problems until they're pretty advanced. And children in particular can't self-identify vision problems. Sometimes they'll tell you it's blurry, but many other conditions manifest even if a child can't notice blurry vision. So it's very important for a doctor of optometry to identify the problems and nip them in the bud and attack or take care of those things very early so they don't impact lifelong skills and learning.
What are some of the problems that we're actually looking for?
So in addition to, does a child need glasses, we want to know if the eyes are performing well together. One common issue is when one eye sees better than the other, the brain can't individually adjust those, so it's going to pick the good eye all the time. And in the meantime, the bad eye is not getting the proper stimulus to the brain, so it will result in permanent deficit of that eye. And as you can imagine, that's going to affect binocularity and depth perception, which extends to not only learning and computer use, but sports and mobility and the ability to drive safely even.
I have always been told that the windows are the eyes to the soul and that you can find out more about a person's health just by examining their eyes. What can we find out beyond eye health when we have an eye examination?
Well, I think it's very fascinating, and I tell my patients the only place in the body we can look directly at your blood vessels and nerve tissue is in the eye without being invasive. There are over 270 diseases of the body that will manifest in the eye. Certainly some are more common than the others, but that change will occur long before a person will notice symptoms. So if we're able to look at the small blood vessels and the place where the eye connects to the brain and see what's happening in there, we're going to get a lot of information about how healthy a person is overall. I don't know about the soul, but the eyes are certainly the window to health in general.
I had two children, and an annual eye exam was, you know, just something we did every year. Is it every year? Is it every 6 months? Is it every 2 years? What's the right amount of time?
Sure. Well, I might surprise you by telling you we want to see infants between the age of 6 and 12 months for their first comprehensive exam. That's when the critical connections are happening between the eye and the brain. We just want to make sure everything's okay. After that, before school starts, between 3 and 5 years of age, we recommend a comprehensive exam. And then once they're in school, an annual assessment. The eyes are responsible for over 80% of learning and you really want to ensure that your child has all guns firing at top speed as they're entering the school environment and advancing, using more screens, more technology, and really having to gather a whole lot more information about the world around them as they grow older in the school years and beyond.
Now, I know parents who are listening to this broadcast might say, well, what can we do at home? How can we protect our children's eyes?
Well, screens are certainly a part of life. It's impractical to think that you might eliminate screen time, but I think most parents are now aware that that's not real good for the eyes or the body to stare at screens. We recommend what we call the 20-20-20 rule. Have your child take a break every 20 minutes, look 20 feet away or more for 20 seconds or more. That shakes out the visual system and sort of relaxes those muscles and the body as well. An annual comprehensive exam, as I mentioned, is very important. And then outside play is very important with sunglasses on. We recommend 2 hours of play outside if that's possible. We know that being outside helps to prevent the onset and progression of myopia or nearsightedness, which globally has become an epidemic. It's a serious problem that can not only affect a child's vision, but their eye health in adulthood. So those are some tips. There are other tips and pieces of information on our website that's easy to access by going to aoa.org/I deserve more. That's EYE, deserve more. And not only will you find tips and information there about protecting your eyes and your children's eyes, but there's a really easy to use doctor locator that will point you to a doctor of optometry in your area. The Ohio State University has an excellent optometry school clinic, and so I know folks in your area can easily access that clinic or an optometrist nearby.
Dr. Jackie Bowen has been joining us today on Columbus Perspective, and we thank you for your insight, no pun intended. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, known as NHTSA, distracted driving causes approximately 8% of all fatal crashes, 13% of injury crashes, and 13% of all police-reported crashes every year. It's an issue that can be prevented with education and safer habits. Now in its 14th year, Project Yellow Light continues its partnership with the Ad Council to raise awareness about distracted driving through its annual student scholarship competition. Julie Garner is the founder of Project Yellow Light and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks so much for having me.
Dom Tiberi is our sports director at WBNS TV 10, the CBS affiliate here in Columbus, Ohio, and unfortunately lost his daughter to a distracted driving incident and has a program here in Columbus called Maria's Message. And I know his answer to this question, but I've got to ask you, how significant is the problem of distracted driving across the country?
Well, my son was also killed in a car crash at the age of 16. And at that time, it was the leading cause of death of our youth. And it is still one of the leading causes of death of our youth in this country. It is prevalent. And we are committed to getting the word out to our youngest drivers to be careful out there on the road.
Hunter was 16 when he passed away?
Yes. Yeah.
And what was the distraction that caused the accident and the fatality?
Well, it was actually his friend who was driving who was also killed at the same time. And it was just young people, another car involved, and they were just, not paying attention to the road at all. And it's just, when something like that happens to you, it's just like your whole world falls apart. And we just knew that we had to do something to keep his name alive and to protect other young people from meeting that same demise. Because particularly with our youngest drivers, they just think it's not going to happen to them, that they can have a cell phone in the car and play around with it and text or whatever. And I am living proof that it can and it will happen to you if you're not careful. So we have, are just passionate about this particular message.
I have two children myself. They are much older than teens now. But I remember, because I've been doing this for 40 years, asking both of my daughters how they respond to messaging. And they were both very candid with me, Julie. They both said, we don't want to hear from adults. We want to hear from people our own age. That's what will get us to pay attention. So this PSA campaign that you started persuades young people from actual young people's perspective. Has that made a difference?
Well, that's so interesting that you bring that up, because that's exactly what we did when we created this. We looked at the messaging that was out there at the time, and it was typically somebody in a uniform or in a suit talking down to youth as if they were 5 years old, or some other kind of show of blood, guts, and gore that was just such a turnoff. And we felt like we have failed as adults, and we wanted to hand this messaging over to the young people themselves, and felt there was no better way to get that message out than that peer-to-peer connection and communication. And so that's how we started it in Hunters High School with a video competition. And 4 years in, we were partnering with the Ad Council, which was just an absolute godsend, and went from one high school to a national competition overnight. Then we added the video, the billboard competition, and radio. So it's just grown substantially over the years, and it's that peer-to-peer communication that I think is really what resonates with our young people.
And I think, and tell me if you agree with this, that it's more than just seeing or hearing somebody your own age on TV or on the radio or on social media platforms. The language has to be right.
Yeah, and something I cannot do, but they can, you know. They have the ability to create something that just kind of really resonates with one another. And we tell them, you know, just to create something that kind of comes from their heart, whether it's the video or the radio or the billboard. They can use humor. They can use animation. They just need to think about it in terms of what would reach themselves or their best friend. And it has worked so beautifully for us.
I remember a specific word that my kids used to use, and this goes back almost 10 years. They would say bet at the end of a comment. And I would say, well, what do you want me to bet on this? And they'd say, no. We're just in agreement. It's almost like saying it shall be so. It's that type of word, that type of language, that type of in-speak, if you will, that may or may not be in the urban dictionary, that I think provides validity so that it doesn't sound like a canned pitch.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, some of the submissions, I'm like, I'm not quite sure I get this, but, you know, and then I run it by somebody else who's a lot younger than me, and they're like, oh, yeah, that really makes sense, you know. So I totally agree. They can talk the talk with each other.
So what are the criteria that you use for judging a submission?
Well, basically, like I said, we have the three different parts of the competition. It's radio, billboard, and video. And we just ask them to create something that speaks from their heart. And, you know, it's, I think, typically the simpler the work, the better. Those are the ones that really stand out for us.
Now, you started this in 2007 or 2008?
2007 is when Hunter died, and we started it up that year and gave out our first scholarship in 2008. And then, like I mentioned earlier, about 3 years after that, the Ad Council brought us on board with them, and it's just grown substantially every year since.
Do you remember the campaign from the first winner selected?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about it. What was it like?
It was just extremely emotional, you know, and one of them was very poignant and serious and lovely, and you know, it's they have so much talent, and I think it's just that raw footage of actually even taking a video from your phone or something that's just amazing, and it just really touches your heart.
Here in Columbus, through Maria's message, we offer driver training for youth, and this training is actual behind the wheel training at actual courses that instruct people how to drive safely and how not to drive distractedly. But if families want to go online and they want to find their own education for distracted driving, where do you send them? What's the best website that you would recommend?
Well, I would say go to our website, projectyellowlight.com, and you can check out everything there. It's all self-contained. You'll learn about our winners, and one of the wonderful components of that is that we announce our winners in Times Square. So not only do our winners get a scholarship prize, our partners spread their word work all throughout the country, and you have that wonderful Times Square event. And you can learn all about the scholarship. You can see the winners. You can find stats and all kinds of information right there, projectyellowlight.com.
We want to thank Julie Garner for her time and her good work. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
There are almost 1 million people now living in Columbus, and the cost of living has been rising for years and continues to increase. Those increasing costs impact everyone. Insurance is no exception. David Sampson is the president and CEO of the American Property Casualty Insurance Association. And he joins us now on Columbus Perspective to explain why insurance costs are rising and what consumers can do, if anything, to lower their premiums. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you, Jay.
What are the main reasons insurance premiums are rising, and is there anything we can do to lower those premiums?
Well, yeah, so there are three primary factors that are driving increased premiums. The first is inflation. We're coming off a period of 40-year record high inflation that peaked in 2021, but those costs are still washing through the insurance system, which is a lagging indicator. So, for example, home construction labor has increased 36% over the last 5 years. Construction materials have increased 42% over the last 5 years. That far exceeds the CPI index. And that's what the first major driver. The second is follows on from that is increased storms and natural catastrophes. We're coming off the costliest five-year period of storm losses in history, $506 billion. So when all of those homes and businesses get damaged, it costs a lot more to repair and replace them. And then the third major factor is runaway lawsuit abuse that's driving up the cost of everything for everyone. Now, what can consumers do? There are steps that consumers can take to help lower their premiums. First of all, shop around when it comes time for your policy renewal. Insurance is a highly competitive industry. You know that in Columbus with all of the insurance companies that are based there in Columbus and in Ohio. So shop around. Contact your agent and broker. Secondly, you can look at increasing your deductibles. That will lower your monthly insurance premiums. Third, consider bundling your home and auto policy. A lot of times that results in significant discounts. Ask your insurer if they have telematics programs that rewards safe drivers. And if you're not driving as much as you used to, many insurance companies are now offering pay-as-you-go insurance policies that you pay by the mile. And finally, Make sure that your home is as resilient as possible. When you consider replacing roofs or windows, look at upgrading those to more storm-resilient products.
Let's go back to litigation for a minute. Why is there so much legal system abuse? What has changed, and what do you mean when you say it's a tort tax?
Yeah, so our legal system is really under assault from both plaintiff's lawyers and financiers who really use the judicial system now as a slot machine, just gambling that if they file 100 lawsuits, then maybe one or two of those are going to result in nuclear or thermonuclear verdicts, which are defined as verdicts of $10 million or $100 million in the thermonuclear case. And what we mean when we talk about a tort tax is that the average family of four pays about $4,200 in increased costs for everything from groceries to gas to utilities because of lawsuit abuse. And what's new about this is shadowy investors are investing in these lawsuits. They're providing the financing to file these lawsuits and making huge profits off of them. And consumers really don't need to do that. If somebody is injured, call your insurance company, agent, or broker first to try to get that resolved. And if it can't be resolved, every state has an insurance department, and they have dispute resolution mechanisms. And so there's a lot more efficient, quicker ways, if there are disputes, to get those resolved than filing a lawsuit in court.
When it comes to the extreme weather that we've talked about, in Ohio last year, for example, we faced a drought and the largest number of tornadoes in the history of the state. This year, we're facing unprecedented rain and flooding. What can we do in terms of new construction, and what can the counties and the state do to help us with facilities to live in that are more weather resistant to today's conditions?
Well, you're exactly right. It comes down to state and local, county, city governments. And the most important thing is zoning decisions. But even more important than that are the building codes that are adopted. There's a lot of research that has been done in recent years on how to make homes more resilient to storms. The National Institute of Building Science has projected that for every $1 spent in new construction on upgraded materials, more hail-resistant shingles, roofs that are strapped down, saves $13 in repair and storm losses when disasters strike. And a really great example of this is if you look back to 2022 in Florida, Hurricane Ian, Babcock Ranch, which is a new housing development, was relatively unscathed, even though it took a direct hit from Hurricane Ian, because storm safety and resilience was engineered into every aspect of that housing development.
That makes a huge difference when it comes to new construction. However, not everybody has the ability to live in a new construction situation. So for all of the things that we've discussed today, it seems like reforms are in order. Are these reforms going to come from the federal level, the state level, or the county level?
Well, it's a combination, really, of all three. But the main area of focus that I would put on is what's happening in Ohio itself. The Ohio legislature has been considering a bill that would require transparency in third-party litigation financing, so that in court, we know exactly who is financing that lawsuit. And in many cases, it's actually foreign sovereign wealth funds that are investing in these lawsuits. It's foreign wealthy individuals that are, in some cases, laundering money to these lawsuits. So that's a state-level initiative that we're very supportive of. But then when it comes to building codes, that's going to be at the county and the city level that needs to be addressed.
Our audience has learned a lot today, but I'm sure they have more questions. What is the best website for information about this subject?
Your listeners can go to apci.org/insurance, and all of this material and more is there if they want to dig in deeper about how they can help control their own insurance premium costs.
All right, we want to thank David Sampson for being with us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
It's official. Former Ohio U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown wants to become Ohio's next U.S. Senator. Brown confirmed the news when he announced plans to run for U.S. Senate. Brown served in the Senate for 18 years until he lost last year's election to Republican Senator Bernie Moreno. The Democrat will face Republican Senator John Husted in November of 2026. Governor Mike DeWine appointed Husted in January to fill the seat left open by now Vice President J.D. Vance. 10TV's Carlo Rogner talked with political experts who expect the race to be competitive and expensive.
I didn't plan to run for office again, but when I see what's going on, I know I can do something about it for Ohio. That's why I'm running for Senate.
Sherrod Brown says in a video announcement he wants to return to the Senate to combat tariffs and changes to health care access resulting from the Big Beautiful Bill.
And he's going to try to tie all this together in one package, I think. Sort of Republicans and Donald Trump and Husted are sort of all for the elite, and Sherrod Brown is here to fight for regular people.
Dr. Mark Caleb Smith, director of the Center for Political Studies at Cedarville University, called the news best case scenario for Democrats.
For the Republicans, this is probably the last person they would prefer to run against. But the Republicans have had some success against him lately.
As Democrats struggle in Ohio in recent years, strategist Morgan Harper says Sherrod Brown will have to change up his playbook.
Spending a lot less time thinking about how do we bring people back who have gone to Trump and a lot more about how do we motivate the people that are on our side likely to begin with, but might not show up if they don't hear something different in this campaign.
She says Brown's campaign needs to focus on people who are unsure about going to the polls.
We need to make sure that we are speaking to the constituencies that have to really show up in big, big numbers to have a chance at being successful here. So that's what young voters care about throughout Ohio. That's what a lot of Black voters care about. These things cannot be an afterthought. They have to be at the center of the campaign from the start, and rebuilding trust among a lot of these constituencies that have started to turn away from Democrats in Ohio.
Dr. Smith says all eyes will be on this race next November, as it could even decide control of the Senate.
I think if you had to place a wager, you know, you would say a Republican at the statewide level is going to be favored in Ohio, just sort of as a general rule. But Sherrod Brown has been extremely competitive. And even in the last election cycle in which he lost, he outperformed other Democrats on the national ballot as well as the statewide ballot. And so I suspect it'll be a good competitive race.
That was Carla Rogner reporting. The day after Brown's announcement, his campaign announced that he had already raised $3.6 million from donations coming in from all 88 counties in Ohio. They say the average donation was $53. U.S. Senator John Husted's team responded to Brown's decision to enter the race. Husted's communications director, Tyson Shepard, writes that for 30 years, Brown has, quote, imposed Washington's problems on Ohio, pushing radical liberal policies that have left a lasting burden on the next generation. John Husted offers the opposite approach, applying Ohio's values and solutions to fix a broken Washington, end quote. Turning to the races for governor and secretary of state right now, some news on the Democratic side. Former Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan is mulling over a run for the state's top office. A spokesman for the Democrat says he will make a final decision sometime by September 30th. Right now, former director of the Ohio Department of Health, Amy Acton, is the only Democrat who is officially in the race. On the Republican side, biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy and former Morgan County School Board President Heather Hill are running. And Thursday morning, State Representative and former House Minority Leader Allison Russo of Upper Arlington announced she is running for Ohio Secretary of State. She'll face Dr. Brian Hambly in the Democratic primary. He is an oncologist from Cincinnati. I'll have more on the Democratic race for Secretary of State coming up later. You'll hear from both of them about their priorities. On the Republican side, current State Treasurer Robert Sprague and Marcel Sturbich are running for Secretary of State. Joining me now to talk about the recent developments are Democratic strategist Morgan Harper, whom you saw just a moment ago, and Republican strategist Matt Dole. Thank you both for being here today. Appreciate it. Morgan, let's start with you. First of all, just what do you think of Sherrod Brown's decision to get back in the Senate race?
I understand it. Sherrod Brown has the most name ID of any Democrat, existing Democratic politician in Ohio, bar none. It's not even close. And that's what a lot of winning races, especially at the statewide level, requires, and being able to generate significant resources, because we know that John Husted will have those with the whole national Republican Party and MAGA movement behind him through the support of Trump. And so I get it. But like I mentioned in an earlier interview with your colleague, but it will require Sherrod Brown doing things differently. It's not going to be enough to run just on his prior reputation and service in the U.S. Senate.
We'll get back into a little bit more of that in just a minute. Matt, what do you think from the Republican perspective about his decision to run for the Senate?
Well, I think he's the best choice for the Democrats, certainly their best option to win. I just think that his record over an incredibly generations of Ohio politics are out of touch with Ohio voters. And I think running for a race that you've lost is harder. I just think he faces an uphill battle, especially in a midterm election.
What do you think John Husted needs to do to win this race against him?
Well, John Husted needs to continue to do what he's been doing. He's a very good general election candidate. John Husted is, I think, probably even better than Bernie Moreno. He has a long history across Ohio as Speaker of the House and Secretary of State, and he has deep connections into county-level Republican parties in Ohio. So I think he'll have the support of Republicans and independents.
And Morgan, for you, what do you think that former Senator Brown needs to do to win this race?
I think it's going to be important for Senator Brown to tap into where the people of Ohio are at. So I don't dispute what Matt's saying in terms of, Husted having support of the Republican Party and this and that. But if the Trump era has taught us anything, that support doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's a lot more about specific candidates that are able to generate that kind of enthusiasm and shift the dynamics politically. Trump has been able to create the stranglehold over Ohio Republican politics. We haven't had that Democratic populist answer. And even though Sherrod Brown had a strong track record, his service in the U.S. Senate, his campaigns haven't necessarily embodied that spirit of being anti-establishment, going after a lot of direct villains, and trying to build that on-the-ground energy beyond just the existing party infrastructure. That is what we call movement building. That is grassroots movement building. And that is not typically what the state party does. And so, being able to really reach out to probably some new allies throughout Ohio, because that organizing does happen, and tap them into this race, in addition to some of the traditional necessary components of a campaign with the money and the name ID and all of that, is going to be critical here to try to answer the populist spirit that has really embodied the Republican Party over the last several years.
So what then do you think the big issues are going to be in this campaign, or the issues that they may attack each other on or promote for themselves?
I do think healthcare, and it's good to hear that he mentioned healthcare, is going to be a big issue, because we are going to see these changes to the availability of coverage of healthcare, both in the changes to the Affordable Care Act marketplace and the premiums that are going to be increasing, and Medicaid, that people who are going to be kicked off of Medicaid. That's going to be a big issue. And that is a cross-class issue as well, in terms of those increased costs. And then the economy overall. President Trump ran on lowering prices. And if you talk to the average Ohioan, I don't know that that's the experience experience, that people are really feeling that prices have gone down, continues to feel like even folks who consider themselves middle class are continuously getting nickeled and dimed and don't feel secure about their future. So in addition to pointing out some of what has happened from this administration and this Congress that John Husted has been a part of perpetuating these financial problems for Ohioans, Sherrod Brown's going to have to present an alternative vision for how he will, in his renewed service, hopefully, improve that financial outlook and for the families of Ohio that will make it a place where they will want to stay and raise families and that their kids will want to be a part of, too.
And Matt, how about for you? What do you see that in this campaign as far as the issues that are going to be really important?
Yeah, I think the Democrats are going to try and nationalize the race and make it a litmus test on President Trump. I think certainly John Husted has an incredible story to tell with the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill. And I think the Congress and the Senate need to continue to take action. And I think John Husted will be at the forefront of that to continue to address concerns like pricing and things like that. Immigration, of course, continues to be an incredible issue and I think a good story to tell on John Husted's side. And there will be plenty to talk about, but I think it will end up being a litmus test of a president's midterm election. Do you support the president or do you not?
And so what do you expect for the tone? Is this going to be nasty, or is it going to be, do you think, civil? How do you think it's going forward?
You can be nasty and civil at the same time. You can
politics,
do that.
Right?
I think you will see an aggressive contrast campaign. I think you will see Sherrod Brown tie John Husted to Donald Trump and all the negatives that his side of the aisle sees there. And I think you will see John Husted try and make the case that Donald Trump's policies are working.
And how about for you, Morgan? What do you think about the potential tone of this election? I mean, campaign.
I do think that it is going to be strong contrast and that we will see Sherrod Brown critique Husted and like Matt was saying, tie him to what's happening nationally. Again, that John Husted now has been part of in passing a lot of these really destructive pieces of legislation. But I would hope to see that we have that same level of aggression from Sherrod Brown directed at some of the additional culprits of what is causing so much financial stress for Ohioans. And that is big insurance companies, big healthcare companies, the big utilities that are driving up electricity costs for a lot of Ohioans. We hear about that a lot from, you know, a lot of the folks that I'm working with. And so bringing some of that anger in this campaign directed at some of those large corporations that are just gouging a lot of Ohioans. That is something, that's what I was talking about earlier about that populist spirit. I think people associate Sherrod Brown with being a senator for the workers and caring about the dignity of work and all of that, but really going that next level and identifying some of these corporations that have been responsible for a lot of the harm that's happened in our communities and being willing to galvanize people around those fights.
And Morgan, both of these men are good fundraisers when it comes to political campaigning. We saw in the last senatorial election between Senator Brown and now Senator Marino, nearly about $500 million spent on the campaign. Do you expect this race to be that expensive?
I'm sure that Sherrod Brown hopes that it will be, because there's no doubt that John Husted is going to be able to raise a lot of money. Being able for the Republicans to continue to secure power in Washington, control the Senate, they will throw everything they can at this race. And the question is, will Sherrod Brown be able to generate the same level of resources now that he isn't defending a seat, but trying to win a seat back? That's a little bit of an open question. I mean, again, I do think he's one of the most strongly situated Democrats in Ohio to be able to even have the possibility of raising that kind of money. But it's not a guarantee it's going to come at the same level, given some of the results that we've had in Ohio. And so hope so. If he can get it, he's going to spend it. But I do think it's important also to look at what that money is spent on, not just ads, but also, again, talking to people directly and kind of building some of that grassroots support. Because we're already seeing early polling, I think, that came out just in the last day or so, showing that even with the name ID Sherrod Brown has, he's behind Husted. And so we do have some work to do here, and it will require a lot of financial backing.
If he gets it, he'll spend it. I like how you put that. And Matt, how about for you? Are you kind of thinking this is going to be way up there on the spending scale as well?
I think it'll be a targeted race. I do think it will depend on how the race develops a little bit. The polling late in the week that showed John Husted at 50% indicates that he is in a real good spot, and that may keep some of the outside money out of the race and targeted in other races that are perceived as more competitive. Both of them will be able to raise money. Both of them will have outside support, and it's just a matter of whether the race develops develops and Brown can make it appear as though it'll be competitive.
And final thoughts, Morgan, from you on this race. What is going to be the key as this kickoff rolls out?
I think it's going to be important for Sherrod Brown to show that though he is a known entity, he is bringing a different spirit to this campaign and being able to really generate that kind of excitement on the ground. And look, I mean, that's not, you know, the most straightforward thing to do when you have been a seasoned politician, but it's not impossible. And so some of the early indicators of what kind of events he has, who he's appearing with, and again, who he's critiquing, not just critiquing Trump, though there's certainly to critique there, but also presenting that affirmative vision that people will want to be part of and make them think that Sherrod Brown is talking about the future is going to be really important here.
And Matt, how about for you? What's the key in the next few weeks or so?
Yeah, I think what's going to be most interesting is how John Husted handles adversity. He's been a Speaker of the House. He's been Secretary of State. He's been Lieutenant Governor. He has not faced the sort of vitriol that he's going to face in this race. And how he answers that will show how independents will treat him and whether the Republican Party will coalesce fully behind him.
Matt Dole, Republican strategist, Morgan Harper, Democratic strategist, thank you both for your time and perspective this morning here on Face the State.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.